Hello everyone, my name is Elijah Davis. This is the 12th hour Apostolic Sabbatarian Congregation Mount Zion of the 12th hour in the Liberty Hill, Texas. Today is December 9, 2016. It is Steve Beth 11, 2020. We will start our first service today with a song entitled The Church and the Wildwood. There's a church in the valley by the wildwood, no lovelier spot in the dale. No place is so dear to my childhood as the little brown church in the vale. Oh, come, 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 come to the church in the wildwood. Oh, come to the church in the vale. No spot is so dear to my childhood as the little brown church in the vale. Church in the wildwood, to the trees where the wildflowers bloom, where the parting hymn will be chanted, we will weep by the side of the tomb. Oh, come, 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 come to the church in the wildwood. Oh, come to the church in the vale. No spot is so dear to my childhood as a little brown church in the vale. How sweet on a clear Sabbath morning to listen to the clear ringing bell. It tones so sweetly your calling, oh, come to the church in the vale. Oh, come, 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 come to the church in the wildwood. Oh, come to the church in the vale. No spot dear to my childhood. It's a little brown church in the vale. Come to church in the valley by the wildwood, when day fades along through the night. I would fade from the spot of my childhood, wing my way to the mountains of light. Oh, come, 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 come to the church in the wildwood. Oh, come to the church in the vale. No spot is so dear to my childhood as a little brown church in the vale. Judgment and the Harvest, Part 1. We're going to do the subject this morning. One of the first subjects that he did, and we're going to start with the introduction. This is written in about 1934. It says, though it is the crowning work of our salvation, and of the sitting up of the kingdom of Yahshua upon the earth, yet the investigated judgment is one of the least understood and most mystified and confused Bible subjects of the age. Were it not essential for our salvation, the enemy would not have expended every possible effort to envelop it in darkness. Imperative then is the unremitting need to search the scriptures as for a hidden treasure, and to beseech Yahweh for the guidance of His Spirit in order rightly to understand this all-important subject. In vain, though, any search for the truth unless the motive be to learn and to do the will of Yahweh. Hence, if any man says Yahshua will do His will, he will know of the doctrine, whether it be of Yahweh, John 7:17. Since the subject of the judgment is taught in the types and in parable, and since the Yahweh explains that his teaching parabolically is so that only his disciples may know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, Matthew 13:11, obviously, therefore, none but his followers can understand the whole truth. For the kingdom of heaven, he says, is like unto treasure hid in a field, the which when a man hath found, he hideth, and for joy thereof goeth and selleth all that he hath, and buyeth that field. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like unto a merchant man seeking goodly a pearl, who when he had found one pearl of a great price, went and sold all that he had, and bought it. Matthew 13:44-46. In these parables, Yahshua clearly sets forth present truth as the indispensable condition for the establishing of his kingdom, and supreme effort as the indispensable condition for the entering into it. Thus none declares the spirit of the prophecy, but those who have fortified the mind with the truths of the Bible will stand through the last great conflict. Unto every soul will come the searching test. Shall I obey Yahweh rather than men? The decisive hour is even now at hand. Are our feet planted on the rock of the Elohim's immutable word? The Great Controversy, page 593-594. Let us come out of the stupor of the presuming on Yahweh's grace, yet regarding him responsible for any consequent issue of our life. He has perfectly done his part in fully charting the narrow path unto the kingdom. Now let us do our honest best to follow therein unto the end of the way, for the joy that awaits us there. But never shall we do to save, so save in the returning unto the old landmarks by forsaking the devil who has turned Yahweh's people from the way of the truth and life and the life of John 14:6 into a way which seemeth right unto a man, but the end of which are the ways of death, Proverbs 14:12. For the light of the testimonies of the prophets, or in the light of the testimonies of the prophets, since by some the position is stoutly maintained that this all-important truth cannot be established by the Scriptures alone, let the readers therefore give attention unto what the Bible says. I beheld till the thrones were set up and for the judgment of starting the judgment of the dead, and the ancient of the days did sit. And the hair of his head like the pure wool, his throne was like the fiery flame, and his wheels as burning fire. A fire stream issued and came forth from before him. 1,000,000 men stood under him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The judgment was set, and the books were opened, Daniel 7:9-10. In this scripture are set forth four pertinent facts. Number one, the thrones were not present prior to the opening of the scene in vision. And that was the opening up in 1844 of the judgment of the dead that's found in Daniel 7:9-10. Number two, for the Ancient of Days came and did sit when the thrones were set up. Number three, then the books were opened. Number four, all of which throne, Ancient of Days, and books reveal a judgment scene. And since the books are obviously the focal point in the scene, the question naturally arises, What is the reason for the books? Fundamental unto a correct concept of the judgment is a correct understanding of the nature of it, and of the reason for the books. As unto the latter, John the Revelator said, And I saw the dead, small and great, stand before Yahweh, and the books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged out of those things which were written in the book. Revelation 20, verse 12. Unquestionably, therefore, the books contain both the names and the records of all who are to be judged. And naturally, these names and records were entered while each person was living. Thine eyes, says the psalmist, did see my substance, yet being unperfect, and in thy book all my members were written, which in continuance were fashioned when as yet there was none of them. Psalms 139:16. The Yahweh shall count when he writeth up the people that this man was born there. Psalms 87:16. Thus does inspiration reveal that each one's deeds are chronicled with a terrible exactness in the books of the heaven, and that is the reason for the books herein. The books in hairs, I-N-H-E-R-E-S, the reason for the judgment, starting in 1844, the two phases of the judgment, and that's the judgment of the dead starting in 1844 for the Adventists. This is doctrine given to the Adventists to open up at the end of the 2300-year prophecy that met its fulfillment in 1844. That was prophesied by William Miller earlier, from 1833 to 1844. It says that not every name that has been entered in the Lamb's books will be retained there. It is borne out with a sad conclusiveness by the following scriptures. And the Yahweh said unto Moses, Whosoever has sinned against me, him will I blot out of my book. Exodus 32:33. And if any man shall take away from the words of the book of this prophecy, Yahweh shall take away his part out of the book of life, and out of the holy city, and from the things which are written in this book. Revelation 22:19. Accordingly, the books contain the names of a mixed multitude, both those who stood firmly in the faith and continued patiently unto the end, and those who did not. Said to Yahshua, He that shall endure unto the end, the same shall be saved. Matthew 24:13. But those who do not endure shall be lost. And these are they likewise which are sown on stony ground, who, when they have heard the word, immediately receive it with the gladness, and have no root in themselves, and to endure but for a time. Afterwards, when affliction of the persecution arises for the word's sake, immediately they are offended. Mark 4:16-17. O Yahweh, the hope of Israel, all that forsake thee shall be ashamed, and they that depart from me shall be written in the earth, because they have forsaken the Yahweh, the fountain of the living waters. They have forsaken Yahshua, the fountain of the living waters. That's the Son. Jeremiah 17:13. So there must come a day of the reckoning, a day when the names of those who are found unworthy of the eternal life will be blotted out of the Lamb's book of life, proceeding from which the only correct term can be investigative judgment. And now that the time is come, that judgment must begin at the house of Yahweh. Thou therefore endure hardness as a good soldier of the Yahshua Messiah. 2 Timothy 2:3. For if it parentheses, the judgment first began at us. That's the house of Israel, when the judgment started. What shall the end be of them that obey not the gospel of Yahweh? 1 Peter 4:17. Now, the talk here is about if the judgment first began at us. Well, this is talking about judgment of the living. This is not talking about the judgment of the dead. The dead don't talk. And there's no representatives there representing the dead to talk for them when the judgment starts for the dead. That's the reason why that judgment convened in heaven, where Yahweh opened up the six books of the book of the seven seals. The first six is open for the judgment of the dead. And the angels are the ones that assisted in this judgment of the dead, examining those books all the way from Adam clear up to the cross. They're the only ones that assisted in that. And now you know why you have so many millions of angels in heaven. It's because those angels have to review millions of records of people's lives. And I mean trillions, billions, billions of people that's walked upon the face of the earth. Of course, not all of those are righteous. The angels only investigated the records of the righteous dead, because the names of the wicked were not in the books where the righteous was being judged. Well, they were at the beginning. But when they opened the books to start the judgment of the dead, the angels then have to separate the bad from the good, the bad from the good. And how did they do that? They looked at the record book, and they seen who all followed the sanctuary system, and they seen who all had their names blotted out on the Day of Atonement on their record. And then their names was placed over on the right side of the ledger after they had their sins blotted out. And those that didn't have their sins blotted out, their names were taken out of the book of records. So all the angels then had to do was just to judge those that had their names retained in the book of records after the Day of Atonement, after they had their sins blotted out in their respective years that they lived. So at the closing of their lifetime, when a person's life was over, they looked at the book of records and they seen if his name was retained on the right side of the ledger of the Day of Atonement. If he had made it through the atonement, got his sins blotted out, and his name was retained, then that's the angel was judged, and then put those names into another book. Okay, that's when it talks about books open here and there. Okay, let's go ahead. It says, since therefore, in the fullness of the time, the judgment will begin in the house of Yahweh, the church, each one is confronted with the imperative need to know how names are retained in the book. We were just talking about that. At the moment we accept Yahshua as our personal Savior through the Word of the Truth, at this supreme moment Yahweh forgives us our sin. And the hands bloodstained by Calvary inscribe our names in the Lamb's Book of Life. Then simultaneously, the pen of the angels begins in the heavenly ledger, the life or death chronicle of our Christian experience separate from our path. Even the very hairs of your head are all numbered, Matthew 10:30. Therefore, suffer not thy mouth to cause thy flesh to sin, and now to say thou before the angel that it was an error, Ecclesiastes 5:6. For in the investigative judgment, the books are open and the deeds done in the flesh are brought to light for a final reckoning before the Ancient of the Days. All who have stood fast unto the end will then forever have their sins blotted from the books and their names retained therein, while all who are not overcomers will then forever have their sins retained in the books and their names blotted therefrom. Always man's greatest test, and one which has ever involved almost an instantaneous decision, has been in the unrolling of the scroll and the eclipse of a past message by a new present truth, or a new one, and that is present truth. On every such occasion, each one has had to decide, shall I heed the new and unpopular truth and walk in its light, joining with those who are despised by nearly every religious leader in the land, or shall I allow myself to be deterred by the decision and counsel of the ministry in my church? When the judgment begins and the books open, and the cases of each generation pass in succession in review before the judicial tribunal, some generations suffer an almost wholesale blotting out of names instead of sins. When the generation of Yahshua's first advent is weighed in the balance of the sanctuary, a whole nation will be found wanting, and their names will be wiped from the book. And so, in a varying degree, it has been at the introduction of some of every message in every age. Different periods in the history of the church have each been marked by the development of some special truth adapted unto the necessities of the Elohim's people at that time. Every new truth has made its way against hatred and opposition. Those who were blessed with its light were tempted and tried. The Great Controversy 609. Accordingly, when a message comes in the name of the Yahweh unto his people, no one may excuse himself from an investigation of his claim. Testimonies on Sabbath School Work, page 65. Lay aside all prejudices, self-opinions, and ideas of men who bear not the mark of the inspiration, and who say in effect by their actions, I am rich and increase as goods and have need of nothing. Truth or prophet, Revelation 3:17. The Bible can be rightly explained only by the Spirit who dictated. He will guide you into all truth, for he shall not speak of himself, but whatsoever he shall hear, that shall he speak, and he will show you things to come, that ye may be established in the present truth. And whosoever blasphemeth against the Holy Spirit speaketh evil against the message, it shall not be forgiven him, for it is the only means whereby we may be saved. John 16:13 and 2 Peter 1:12, Luke 12:10. Consequently, the greatest danger of the people has not been their listening unto error, but rather by rejecting, rather their rejecting present truth. If a message comes, saith the Yahweh, that you do not understand, take pains that you may hear the reasons the messenger may give, then produce your strong reason, for your position will not be shaken by coming in contact with error. Testimonies on the Sabbath School Work, page 65 and 66. Wherefore let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall. 1 Corinthians 10:12. Treat therefore any attitude which disposes one not to make a candid investigation of any message that purports to be additional truth must inevitably bring ruin upon oneself. While on the other hand, he who accepts the truth but fails faithfully to live and to proclaim it, thereby brings upon himself ruin also, that against which Ezekiel warns, when a righteous man doth turn from his righteousness and commit iniquity, and I lay a stumbling block, a message before him, he shall die because I have not given him warning, he shall die in his sin, and his righteousness which he hath done shall not be remembered. And but his blood will I require at thine hand. Nevertheless, if thou warn the righteous man that the righteous sin not, and he doth not sin, he shall surely live, because he is warned. Also thou hast delivered thy soul. Ezekiel 3:20-21. But the wicked shall be blotted out of the book of the living, and not be written with the righteous. Psalm 69:28. Thus solidly established the foregoing position on the inevitable judgment makes all opposing positions unfounded conclusions. Because of their erroneous belief that the Yahweh throne has always been in the sanctuary and that Yahshua, after ascending on high, sat there at the right hand of his Father, men have put forth every effort possible to prove that Yahshua entered within the veil immediately after he left his disciples. But as all such efforts, albeit ever so well-meaning in the interest of the truth, are put forth by minds inspired not by the spirit of the truth, but rather by the preconception, we must therefore diligently entreat the Yahweh for the promised Comforter to lead us into all truth, and to save us from being presumptuous and from blindly taking things for granted and forming conclusions without digging beneath the surface. We have also a more sure word of prophecy, says the Apostle Peter, whereunto you do well that you take heed as unto a light that shines in a dark place, until the day dawn and the day star arise in your heart. Knowing this first, that no prophecy of the Scripture is of any private interpretation, for the prophecy came not in the old time by the will of man, but holy men of Yahweh spake as they were moved by the Holy Spirit. 2 Peter 1:19-21. For the wise reader, therefore, will henceforth cease giving place unto human theories and speculations, which tempt him unto the uttermost to make flesh his arm. He will instead attend diligently unto the Bible prophecy and unto the inspired interpretations, and will learn therefrom that the sanctuary is Yahweh's temporary throne room. Since the earthly beings themselves, having never been in the heaven, are naturally strangers unto heaven's reality, 1 Corinthians 2:9, then in order for Elohim to make heavenly truth known unto them, he must reveal it by the means of the earthly reality with which they are familiar. Hence, through the sanctuary work on the earth is seen the sanctuary work in the heaven, Hebrews 9:1-9. Indeed, the sanctuary above, being the pattern of the one below, the services of the former are therefore definitely revealed in the services of the latter, and the fact that the earthly sanctuary was appointed as a place for the confession and for forgiveness of sin shows that the throne room and the heavenly sanctuary is only temporary. From it, while sin exists, Yahweh carries on the work of removing from the universe sin and sinners. And this light, in turn, clearly shows that not until after sin came into the universe could the sanctuary congruously have existed in heaven. I looked, exclaimed the Revelator, about 96 A.D. upon being shown the throne and the sanctuary. And behold, a door was open in heaven, and the first voice which I heard was as it were of a trumpet talking with me, which said, Come up hither, and I will show thee things which must be hereafter. And immediately as in the spirit, and behold, a throne was set in the heaven, and one sat on the throne, and he that sat was to look upon like a jasper and a sardine stone, and there was a rainbow round about the throne, and sight like unto an emerald, and round about the throne were 24 seats. And upon the seats I saw 24 elders sitting, clothed in a white raiment, and they had on their heads crowns of gold. And out of the throne proceeded lightnings and thunders, and voices, and there were 7 lamps of fire burning before the throne, which are the 7 spirits of Yahweh. And before the throne there was a sea of glass like unto crystal, and in the midst of the throne and round about the throne were 4 beasts full of eyes before and behind. And I beheld, and lo, in the midst of the throne and of the 4 beasts, and in the midst of the elders stood a lamb as it had been slain, having 7 horns and 7 eyes, which are the 7 spirits of Yahweh sent forth into all the earth. And I beheld, and I heard the voice of many angels round about the throne, and the beasts, and the elders, and the number of them was 10,000 times 10,000, and thousands of thousands. Okay, Revelation 4, 1 to 6, and 5, 6. Here is brought to view a twofold scene. On the one hand, before the throne are the 7 lamps burning, and the lamb as it had been slain, showing that the throne was set there to serve in the time of the probation. The light from the candlestick represents the light of the truth in the church, while the blood of the Lamb is atoning for the sinful being. On the other hand, upon the throne sits the Ancient of Days, the judge, surrounded by the jury of 24 elders, plus the angelic witnesses, 10,000 times 10,000 and thousands of thousands of them, plus the 4 beasts, who being redeemed out of every kindred and tongue and people and nation, Revelation 5, 8 and 9, are therefore symbolical of the saints. All those whose sins will be blotted from the books of record, just as the beasts of Daniel 7 are symbolical of all the kindreds which will perish in their sins, with the Lamb, our advocate, in the midst. All this shows a combined mediatorial judicial work. Now, so far we see that when John in the vision beheld the door of the veil as it opened into the most holy apartment of the heavenly sanctuary, he was permitted to look within, and that the things which he saw would take place hereafter from his time, showing thereby that at the time of his vision, about 96 A.D., the most holy apartment was closed. In addition to this, we shall now see from Daniel's prophecy that the judgment throne was set up in the most holy apartment of the heavenly sanctuary after the little horn of Daniel 7 came up. I consider the horn, says the seer, and behold, there came up among them another little horn, before whom there were 3 of the first horns plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. I beheld how the thrones were set up. It says here were cast down, and that is the wrong use of the term. If you're going to set thrones up to start the judgment, you don't use that terminology, cast down, but the Bible has it that way. The translators put it that way. And I don't understand why, unless they had a Hebrew word that meant the same thing as cast. In other words, cast down means to set up the thrones in a position around the great throne, where the Father sits, the judge. Eshkol, and the Ancient of Days did sit. Whose garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head like the pure wool. His throne was like the fiery flame, and his wheels as the burning fire. A fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. Thousands ministered unto him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The judge was seated, and the books were opened. Daniel 7:8-10. These verses reveal that after judgment was said and the books were opened, the Son of Man, Yahshua, was then brought into a position, not at the right hand of Yahweh, the Ancient of Days, but near before him, Daniel 7:8-10, 13. Both John's and Daniel's vision revealed that the throne in the sanctuary was not there from the beginning of the creation of Yahweh, or from the days of Moses, or yet from the hour that Yahshua ascended on high, or even from the days of the pagan Rome, that indeed it was not set up until after the fall of pagan Rome, when the little horn of the nondescript beast came up in the days of the ecclesiastical Rome, Daniel 7:7-12, 21-22. Elsewhere, then, in the sanctuary, therefore, is the Elohim's eternal throne room. Because the sanctuary throne was not in existence in the days of the early Christian church, therefore the throne upon which Stephen saw Yahshua at the right hand of Yahweh, Acts 7:56, could not have been in the sanctuary, wherein is the sea of glass, but rather in paradise, whence flows the river of the water of life, and on the other side of which is the tree of life, Revelation 22:1-2. Very obviously, therefore, the throne that Stephen saw is the throne of Yahweh and of the Lamb, the throne permanent and eternal. Round about this throne, round about this glorious seat, are no beasts, no witnesses, no jury. And before it is no candle and no blood to be offered. In short, it stands not in the sin-laden sanctuary, but in the paradise. It is a sovereign administrative throne from which the infinite eternal governs his immortal sinless being. Unto this throne then, which is from everlasting to everlasting, Yahshua ascended, and therefore And thereat sat down at the right hand of his Father until the time came when, and the fulfillment of Daniel's prophecy and of John's revelation, something after the little horn power came into the existence. Both he and his Father moved unto the sanctuary throne. Upon the latter, he does not sit as a king at the right hand of Yahweh, but rather before it does he stand both as a sacrificial lamb, Revelation 5:6, and as an intercessor, Daniel 7:13, pleading for the sinful human beings. Hence, his mediatorial work began first in the holy, then in the most holy. In the earthly sanctuary, the high priest typifying Yahshua officiated first in the holy apartment throughout the year, then upon the Day of the Atonement, the day of the cleansing of the sanctuary and judging of the people, he officiated in the Most Holy for one day only. This twofold service signifies that in the heavenly sanctuary, the high priest, Yahshua, must necessarily first officiate in the holy apartment up until the antitypical Day of the Atonement. Then during that day, he must officiate in the Most Holy apartment before the throne. Thus, the earthly service is to repudiate the idea that Yahshua entered the Most Holy apartment of the heavenly sanctuary immediately after his ascension. Very plainly, then, the ceremonial system reveals that from the time Yahshua sat on the right hand of Yahweh, Mark 16:19, where the river of the water of life is, until the time that he and the Father moved to the throne, onto the throne in the sanctuary, where the sea of glass and Daniel 7, 9, and 10, Revelation 4, 6, he officiated in our behalf as a high priest in the holy place, Hebrews 9, 12. And that at the same time, conjointly with the Father on the eternal sovereign throne, the throne of Yahweh and of the Lamb, he ruled the sinless universe. From the foregoing facts clear and distinct, the only tenable conclusion to be drawn is that the Yahshua immediately after his ascension, rather than that entering within the veil, in the sanctuary, sat down at the right hand of his Father in paradise, and from there carried on his work in the holy apartment of the sanctuary. How clear already the light of the truth at last shining forth on this all-important subject of the salvation so long shrouded in the dense fog of the human theories and speculations, and how solid the resultant vindication of the spirit of the prophecies, a reaffirmation of his position on the subject. That the sanctuary question stands, and the righteousness and truth, just as we have held it for so many years. Gospel Workers, page 303. Cast not away, therefore, your confidence, which hath great recompense of reward. For you have need of patience, after you have done the will of Yahweh, you might reveal and receive the promise. For yet a little while, and he that shall come and will not tarry. Hebrews 10:35-37. Now the things which we have spoken, this is the sum. We have such an high priest, who is set on the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heaven, a minister of the sanctuary and of the true tabernacle, which is Yahweh pitched and not man, Hebrews 8:1. For Yahshua has not entered into the holy places made with hand, which are the figures of the true, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of Yahweh. Okay, let's do that again. For the Yahshua has not entered into the holy places made with the hands, which are the figures of the true, but into heaven itself now to appear in the presence of Yahweh for us. Hebrews 9:24. Indeed, now, once in the end of the world hath he appeared to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. And as it is appointed unto men once to die, but after this to judgment, Hebrews 9:26-27, the cleansing of the sanctuary, Daniel 8:14. Plainly, therefore, the judgment is to begin, and the sanctuary to be cleansed not before but after the millennium, fulfillment of the period for those appointed to die. For the judgment, being consistent with the records found in the books of the heaven, the names, therefore, of those who are found unworthy without the wedding garment on are blotted from the books. Thus is the sanctuary cleansed, speaking of the commencement of this work of the judgment and cleansing, the angel said unto Daniel, under 2,300 days then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. Daniel 8:14. Since the cleansing accordingly takes place at the termination of the 2,300 days, and since it is, as we have seen, the judgment which takes place in the end of the world, Hebrews 9:26. Consequently, the termination of the days and the beginning of the mediatorial judicial work of Yahshua are, upon the authority of inspiration itself, time unto the end of the world. Hence, conclusively, the 2,300 days do not end in the days of the Antiochus Epiphanes, as some teach. They do this untenable position on the subject along with other similarly unsupportable views on it. Therefore, makes necessary in order to establish the very date of the cleansing, our first dispelling the confusion concerning the 2,300 days. those who are in opposition unto the doctrine that the 2300 days find their terminus and the end of the world are among themselves a strong variant over when the days do supposedly end, and as they are over the truth of a multitude of other doctrines, fully evident, therefore, is the fact that none of them have the truth on the subject, and yet in spite of this fact, they fail to see that the spirit which has led them into their present state of the schism, doctrinal difference, strife, and confusion, unparalleled in history, cannot possibly be the spirit of the truth, who alone can lead them into the truth of the 2300-day prophecy. Thus they continue darkening Christendom with what they imagine and proclaim to be light on it in the effort for the supporting of their position. For they bring in the Septuagint and the Vulgate and the English Revised Version. These in the order named variously render the number in Daniel 8:14 as the 2400, 2200, and 2300 evening and morning. This difference alone is ample proof that the rendering are not the sound results of the exact literal translation of the verse, but rather are the product of the interpretative translations of it engendered of the theological preconceptions on the subject. Nevertheless, even these renderings as they stand lend such feeble plausibility unto the theories held and the opposition unto the doctrine that the 2300 days terminate in the end of the world as to compel the theorizer to read into Daniel 8:14 the word sacrifice, so as to transform the evening morning phase of the text to read evening morning sacrifices. Next, on the grounds that there were two sacrifices a day, they split the number of them in half, and the number being 2400, 2200, or 2300, depending on which version they use, they get respectively 1200, 1100, and 1150 days. This adding to and cutting down, they then boldly put forth in the proof of their theory, although there is no escaping of the crystal clear meaning of the evening morning when viewed in the light of the Genesis 1:5, which, as every Bible student well knows, can only mean a 24-hour period, both the night and the day, and which has nothing to do with the sacrifice. Very plainly, therefore, the numbers 2400 and 2200 and the interpolation of the word sacrifices are the vain results of the false interpretation of the Daniel's prophecy, for the discrepancies between the two figures is due and for the and the difference unto the difference and the dates necessary to work out the different ideas on the text, exposing both the ambition and the fate of those responsible for this vain attempt to place the fulfillment of the prophecy, the Yahweh declared unto Daniel, also the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish the vision that they shall fall, Daniel 11:14. Though the endeavor of these robbers of Yahweh's people to make the vision fit their ideas is doomed to failure, yet in their blind self-confidence they still try their best to establish it, even going so far in the effort as to make the writings of Josephus seem to speak as sacred history in support of their theory. And indeed it so came to pass, says the Jewish historian in a passage which they most commonly use, that our nation suffered these things under Antiochus Epiphanes, according to Daniel's vision, and what he wrote years before they came to pass. Antiquities, Luke 12, chapter 5. though Josephus does not even remotely allude to the number of days mentioned in Daniel 8:14, yet because he does apply the vision unto the work of the Antiochus Epiphanes, they in effect take him as a prophet inspired to interpret the scriptures. Being merely a historian though, and not a prophet, he accordingly in writing the history of the Jews made only a historical application of the similarity which he saw between Daniel's prediction and Antiochus' work, and such was well within his providence as a historian, that his not having the gift of prophecy forbids Yahweh's people from accepting his applications of the scriptures as authoritative and dependable. From this sort of the lesson, juggling, rationalizing, and explaining away out of the simple fact, the candid reader will see unto what lengths men are going in order to dodge the revealed truth which they do not like, and to lock arms with the private theories unto their liking. True indeed is the saying, give a man a theory and the facts will come trooping after. With the mist of error not dispelled, our way is clear to proceed in ascertaining what the 2300 days began and end. When the 2300 days began and end. Daniel 7. It was seen that the throne of the judgment or the blessing of the cleansing was not to be set up until sometime after the little horn tower came into existence. Now, that little horn tower represented the Catholic Church during the Inquisition from 538 AD to 1798, a 1260-year period. While from Hebrews 9:24-27, it was seen to be set up sometime before the end of the world. Now to throw into full focus the light on the facts already brought forth, we must go to Daniel 8 and 11 and to the express prophecy of the subject of 2300 days. Okay, it says Daniel 8, 11 and 12. Yea, he magnified himself even unto the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away. Okay. And the place of his sanctuary was cast down. And an host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of the transgression, and it cast down the truth unto the ground, and it practiced and prospered. An arm shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of the strength, and shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate. From this juxtaposition of the Daniel 8, 11, and 12, and Daniel 11, 31, the reader will observe that both scriptures are speaking of the same power. And the Yahshua is with the predicting of the signs of the end of the world, as you look forward along the stream of time, declared when you, his followers who were to be living at the time that this horn power was at work against the Father, his truth, and his people, therefore shall see the abomination of the desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place. Whoso readeth, let him understand. Then let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains. Matthew 24:15-16. These clear words of Yahshua himself placed the work of this power in the future from his time. Here Yahshua plainly states that at his time the abomination of desolation had not yet stood up in the holy place, but that sometime in the Christian dispensation, it would be seen to stand there. Still further, the angel instructed Daniel that at the time of the end shall the vision, Daniel 8:13, 17. These two facts carry a sweeping proof that the 2300-day period did not terminate until following Yahshua's time, the daily, be cast out and the abomination set up for both of these events were to take place within the 2300 days. This desolating power was, according to Daniel, to pollute by transgression the earthly sanctuary or church. This was to be accomplished by casting down the truth onto the ground, by taking away the daily, and by bringing into the holy place the abomination that maketh desolate, all of which was to be, said the angel, under 2,300 days, and then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. From the weighty evidences here amassed, there is manifestly but one conclusion possible. For the polluting of the holy place and the terminating of the 2300 days and the cleansing of the sanctuary could not have taken place before the Yahshua's time. Facing the resounding finality of this threefold conclusion, the numerous voices which insistently localized within the Old Testament period the events bound up with the 2300 days ought now to silence themselves completely and forever. But if they do not, then Yahweh only knows what they may next proclaim. You cannot afford, brethren, now that the light has come, to let slip from you the opportunity of breaking away from the theories of men herein discredited by the spirit of the truth, and of the placing your feet firmly on the solid foundation here established in their place by the testimony of the Yahshua Messiah. Upon this solid rock, the structure of the truth now and building will, as the reader can already see, withstand the most severe storm of both wind and rain. So let us end the proceeding to erect a superstructure liberally utilized without the slightest fear of the coming storm, which will demolish and sweep away everything standing on a sandy foundation, the material so freely given. For the cleansing of the earthly sanctuary, for the abomination which the wicked power here under discussion brought in must necessarily be cast out, and then the truth also, the daily, which the same power trod down and cast out, must be restored. Very obviously, therefore, there is not the slightest room for doubt as to either the way in which the sanctuary was polluted or the way in which it must be cleansed. So, folks, this restoring of the daily, I have done this since 2000. And since 2002, I have restored the daily. It was restored by Verlis Johnson in 1970, but he rescinded it over the years. And I had to restore the daily, along with all the divine institution, the sacred name and all of that, since 2003, for the foundation and the constitution of the Mount Zion in the 12th hour, that is the name of our congregation. This is the name of what we call the church of today. This brings the close of our study this hour. Contact us at the 11th hour call, and it's number 11. Click on our audio archives, hear this message and more. We're going to close now with a song. Again, this is a song that I've written as my sentimental favorite, Dusty Roads and Sandal Feet. Often crossed, taking from his burdens all alone. water into wine, cast that pin to the blind, and that's how I believe in that man of Galilee. Thirsty roads for his companion, desert places his abode, sandal feet were often weary underneath a heavy load. Never complain as he went along his way, on the way to Mount Calvary and the judgment day. Dusty roads, sandal feet, oh, the journey was complete. Here goes Golden Street to a place in the plan where someday we all shall meet. The author of the story, Dusty Roses and Feet. Dusty Roses and Feet, oh, the journey was complete. From the manger to the cross. Here goes Golden Street to a place in the plan where someday we of the story, Dusty Roses and Sandal Feet. Author of the story, Dusty Roses and Sandal Feet.